Them Bash. I'm Sarah Glynn for Media News, and today I'll be talking politics with Gordian Jemai, a human rights activist originally from Rojalat or East Kurdistan. That's the part that's in Iran. So welcome to Media News, Gordian.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me here today. We can go on, I think.
Thanks for being with us. So it's now almost a year since the death of Gina Amini at the hands of Iran's morality police. And after the initial excitement surrounding the protests and the widespread adoption of the slogan of women, life, freedom, and often by people with no concept of its radical source or meaning, Iran has really faded from the international news. So I want to take the opportunity to find out what the situation is there today. But first, before we do that, can you very quickly remind us of the position of the Kurdish minority in Iran and of their role in the protests over the last year?
Basically, if I want to go to the biggest part of the Kurdish people in this revolution or movement, it's the main slogan, Zindagi Azadi. That slogan spread throughout Iran and all the world very quickly, just a few days after Gina's death. So I can say that the context behind this slogan has become the main, how can I call it? It's the main leading project, if I want to call it, behind this whole revolution, because this revolution was about women and their rights and their freedom. And Gina was killed because she was a woman and a Kurdish woman. So the Kurdish role in this revolution is very important, because the most intense protests were actually in Kurdistan and then in Balochistan and then in other parts of Iran. So this is the role of Kurdish people in this revolution, as this slogan and this whole idea of women being free comes from Kurdistan. But if you want to go to other levels and compare the differences between the things that people want in Iran, Kurdistan, and Balochistan, then we can discuss this further. I don't know if we want to do this or not.
I think it would be very helpful, actually, to look at what the demands of the revolution are, absolutely, and how they might vary in the periphery and in the center in Tehran.
Yeah, that's great. So basically, you know, the Kurdish society is very different from the Persian society, like both culturally and politically. So if you want to compare, it's like that the Persians already have some of their rights as the ruling people, but the Kurdish people don't have many of those rights. For example, the right to the mother tongue, the rights to free education, and many, many other rights. That the list is very long, actually. If you look at the numbers, the majority of arrests, I mean, in the past 3-4 months, all of them, like not all of them, but the majority of them, maybe more than 50% of them, are just from Kurdistan. And also the numbers for executions, for the torture, and all of these, majority of these numbers, cases are for Kurdish people. So that's the difference between the demands and also how the regime treats people. At the same time, I want to mention this too. The regime also treats the Baluch people even worse. And we also, like, we always hear really horrible news from Balochistan, that how the regime killed civilians just on the streets.
And I was wondering to what extent economic issues are entering into the protests. I know that there've been previously a lot of strikes, a lot of protests about lack of income, lack of pensions, and that the Kurds and the Baluchs are very economically oppressed as well. So to what extent are economic issues there?
Well, if you want to go about that, it's very hard. Like, I just want to give you some, first, I want to compare how the regime treats Kurdistan and Balochistan economically. So there is a province, Isfahan. It has a population of 5 million. And there are four Kurdish majority provinces in Iran. The budget that the government gave to this province, to Isfahan, was five times more than the entire budget that it gave to the to four Kurdish provinces. So this is how we like, if you want to understand how they treat Kurds and Baluchis there, the economy is very bad there. The people are dealing with extreme poverty. That's why a phenomenon like Kulberi or Sufberi exists, where a lot of people can't find any jobs, they don't have any income, and they just go for this very dangerous job, which the regime kills and injures them all the time. So this is how it is like that. And at the same time, the regime has made the situation very hard for people, that they cannot even create jobs or invest in anything. So it's just like the regime basically bans any productive economic activity. So like, if I want to go back to where I come from, Urmia, it's a major hotspot for agriculture, and the majority of the lands that are under agriculture, they are just they belong to the people affiliated with the regime. But in Kurdish regions, if Kurds want to farm, or if they want to work, the regime puts a lot of pressure on them. For example, about 2 months ago, there were some reports on Kurdish human rights organizations that in some villages in Kurdistan, the regime has forced people to become the members of IRGC or Basij organization in order to be allowed to take their livestock, to their animals out on the mountains for grazing. So these are just a very few examples of how the situation is there. And unfortunately, because of this, because these families have no other income, they had to become the members of IRGC and Basij organization. So yeah, the regime treats people this way in terms of economy.
So it's quite similar to people being forced to become village guards in Turkey, perhaps.
Yes, exactly. Actually, this is interesting. The policies that both these governments use are very, very, very similar.
So just to return, having seen that the situation and how appalling, what an appalling situation the Kurds are in, and why they've been so predominant in leading these protests. But to put it in the bigger picture of the protests across Iran, what extent do people recognize that Kurdish leading role? And how is the fact that the protests have come from the periphery and not from Tehran impacted their subsequent development?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. This revolution basically is the revolution of oppressed people, right? Because until now, the major protests, the major crackdowns have been outside of Persian regions, or as we call it, the central Iran. I want to extend this. In the first month, when the protests were very intense everywhere, everyone knew that this revolution, this whole things started in Kurdistan, and later it spread to Balochistan with the massacre of the bloody Friday of Balochistan, which over 100 people were killed. But unfortunately, after a few months, the Persian or the Iranian opposition groups in the West, especially the Pahlavis and the white the sorry the right wings and basically the extremists, the Iranian extremists, they changed everything because of their power, especially in the media. And they tried to introduce this revolution as a nationalistic Iranian revolution. And even now, these we call them Pahlavists. The Pahlavists, they don't call it Xinjiang Azadi Revolution or the women's revolution. They just call it Iran's national revolution. Because they don't want to acknowledge that where this revolution started.
I wonder if you could talk a bit about the role of organized political groups. So I'm thinking both of the Kurdish groups, but also perhaps Iranian left groups as well.
Well, you know that these parties have historical roots in Kurdistan, especially the KDP. I mean, the original one that was founded by Kurdistan Republic's president, Qazi Muhammad. So these parties still have some sort of popularity in East Kurdistan, mostly because of their history, especially with Qazi Muhammad and Dr. Abdulrahman Qasimlu, and their role in the first, I want to call it in the first resistance against the Islamic Republic. And in the latest revolution, I mean Jinnah's revolution, as we call it, they also played a great role. They tried. Somehow they tried to put all their disputes away and work together towards a common goal, which was fighting the regime and helping the people out. But yeah, these parties played a great role in organizing people and also leading them to peaceful protests. If you check their statements, they were always calling people out for peaceful protests. And they didn't want to directly get involved inside East Kurdistan because they said that if they get involved and join the people in on the streets, the regime would basically bomb all the cities and villages in Kurdistan, as they bombed the Kurdish party's bases in Iraqi Kurdistan just 1 week after Jinnah's death. So yeah, this is their role, and the people, like I see that a lot of activists they criticize some of their moves, and they say that the parties still should work together. But generally, these parties are still popular, and people still somehow see them as a force that they can rely on if one day there will be, I don't know, a more intensive attack on Kurdistan. I mean, a military attack.
But that's sort of
So.
an organizational role. I was wondering about a political educational role, about perhaps coordinating and putting forward an alternative program, because we know what we're against, but what are they arguing for?
Yeah, basically all these parties they are somehow promoting the idea of a federal Iran, a federal state. And they're actually working together with other parties from other minorities like Baluch and Azeri and Ahwazi Arabs. This idea is being promoted a lot by these parties. I think almost all Kurdish parties across Kurdistan right now, they want to live in a federal or confederal system. But right now, the Kurdish parties in East Kurdistan, they are promoting the idea of federalism. I think, like, I personally believe that they are not fully honest about federalism, because the Kurdish people's demand, we all know it, it's a fully independent Kurdish state, fully independent Kurdistan. But due to the situations right now, that can't happen. So the Kurdish parties have limited their demands to a federal system or confederal system, so at least that they could help people, help Kurdish people to gain some of their basic rights, just for now. Maybe in the future, they could gain independence, you know, through a democratic system or whatever. But right now, all of them are trying to promote this, and they're discussing this with Persian oppositions as well. And I also think that they are doing this to not make the Persian oppositions more mad.
I guess we have to be careful about characterizing all Persians together, just as we would.
No, when I say Persians or the Persian opposition, I mean the Pahlavists, the right wings, or the fascists, these ones. However, I forgot to answer your question about the leftist Persians. Unfortunately, when you talk to them, when you connect with them, they all claim that they support the rights of minorities and stuff like that. But at the end, they all agree on one thing, and that is that the territorial integrity of Iran should not be changed.
So how important are more traditional, left issues in this, and are the trade unions playing any role? I mean, in 1979, the trade union strikes played a huge role. So why have we not seen anything approaching that this time? I mean, there's been a few strikes, but not on a significant scale.
Yeah, that's true, actually. I don't know how familiar are you with the Iranian regime's government system. After the Islamic Revolution, the regime, or I would say the IRGC, took over all the power, from economy to politics to culture, everything. So these unions, they exist. Like, they have an office, they have branches everywhere in all cities, but they have no power. They're just there for the sake of formality, and even if they exist, the managers, the people there, they're mostly the regime's people. You know, they're mostly IRGC members. So that's why these unions actually have no power anymore. And as I said, that how IRGC has taken over all the economy in Iran, majority of these massive industrial institutions or companies are now owned by IRGC. So they wouldn't let that happen. You know, it's their own companies and their own institutions. So that's why they have these unions can't do anything as they did in 1970s and 80s.
So I wondered, we've talked quite a lot about all the difficulties, but I wondered if you could just sum up the current situation for us, because it seems that the protests themselves have diminished, petered out. I don't know if how much so, and how, if that's a universal thing or if things are still happening, perhaps in Kurdistan, Balochistan. But at the same time, we've seen no diminution of the crackdown on people, and a lot more arrests, disappearances, reports of torture, and an awful lot of death penalties being put into practice, though they don't get mentioned in international media because they're hidden as ordinary crimes rather than political crimes. But huge numbers of people being killed by the state. So, what's happening, and do you see the possibility of protests re-emerging again in the future, perhaps on the anniversary of Jinnah's death?
Although the protests have somehow died and stopped, but the crackdown has not. I have to say this, that the weekly protests on every Friday still continue in Balochistan, which it's really surprising that the regime isn't so aggressive towards them, like as they were in the first days of revolution. The protests have died somehow, but we have daily reports of arrests, especially in Kurdistan. As I mentioned before, in the past month, I don't exactly remember the numbers of the arrests, but I think over 62% of the arrests were in Kurdistan, and or the cases were Kurdish people, because they basically arrest anyone in Kurdistan who publicly, whether on social media or on I don't know, in public, that they protest or do any type of civil or political activity. Even they arrest the environmental activists, especially during the fires, the fires that they set to the jungles themselves. And at the same time, they have intensified executing people in prisons, and usually more than 50% of these cases are Kurdish. And yes, they are labeled as drug dealers, I don't know, murderers, rapists, and stuff like that. But we know that the Iranian regime's judiciary system basically is not just. There is no justice in that system, nothing. So majority of these people who are being executed, they never have a fair trial or even access to a lawyer, and sometimes they're just labeled with different, like, ordinary crimes. And sometimes there are some cases that we know that they have been executed. Like if you check the human rights organizations and their information, you'll see that some of these cases exist, but nobody knows what are their names or why they have been executed. There is no information about that, except that we know that somebody has been executed. So, and most of these cases, they're again either Kurdish or Baluch people. And recently, I also saw some cases that were for Afghan citizens that were arrested, for I don't know what reasons in Iran. And two of these Afghan citizens were arrested, and they were accused of some terrorist action, if you check the news. So yeah, these crackdowns still continue. And at the same time, I have to say this as well, majority of Kurdish cities and towns are still militarized. There are military patrols in almost all cities every day. And in the first days of revolution, they started putting checkpoints on the entrance and exits of all cities, which they still exist in most cities and towns. So, or I better say that East Kurdistan has been militarized since the Islamic Revolution, I mean, in 1979. But after this Jinan's Revolution, things got just more intense. So that's how the situation is there right now. And as it's summer there in Kurdistan, as usual, I mean, this is an annual thing. And the regime does this every year. They set fire to the forests and pastures across Kurdistan, and they use it as a means to fight against the Kurdish parties or Kurdish fighters that are hiding in the forest. And also, they do this to distract people's attention from the revolution or the main issue. So the people get busy with this for some time. And also, it's a part of their major oppression or systematic program that they want to turn Kurdistan into a unlivable environment, so that the people just move to another place, like a demographic change. And also, like, besides setting fire to the forest, they have dried Lake Urmia, which is the biggest lake in Kurdistan. So this also is causing a lot of problems and tensions in the community. So yeah, this is what they do.
I often wonder, with the attacks on nature in Kurdistan, if there's also a cultural element there, and because nature is so important to Kurdish culture and the mountains.
Yes, the nature is very important to us, because in Kurdish we just don't say environment, we say jinga. It means where you live, and we believe that the humans, like, this is what basically it's believed, that the humans in Kurdistan are a part of this jinga, or where people live and where animals live. So it's important to protect this. But the regime knows this, and they usually destroy our nature and environment just as a means of oppression.
And the other half of my last question, do you see protests? The potential for protests rising up again?
Actually, this is very hard to predict, because we almost have 1 month. It's really hard to say that, whether if it's going to happen again or not, because...
Well, you say 1 month until the anniversary of Jinnah's.
Yeah, almost 1 month. The thing is that, because in the first weeks and month of the revolution, the regime massacred our people in Kurdistan and Balochistan. Majority of the victims are actually whether Baluchi or Kurds or from other minorities. So, and unfortunately, this is a fact that we all discuss it all the time, that the Persian cities, the Persian regions, were not as involved as Kurdistan or Balochistan, or let's say the northern part of Iran, which is on the Caspian Sea coast. So this, like, I see a lot of people talk about it, and they say that the change should be in Tehran, because 70% of Iran's power and wealth is centered in Iran, in Tehran. So if there should be a change, it should be in Tehran. The government, the regime is in Tehran, and all of their power is there. So that's where the regime should be destroyed first. So a lot of people are saying that Kurdistan and Balochistan should not start the protest again, because the regime will just massacre people, and the center will stay silent, which is partly true. So I really can't say that if it's going to be like last year or not, but just as we're talking, the regime is preparing. We are seeing videos and footage that the regime is deploying heavy reinforcements to different cities. I mean, especially the cities that were really active in the protests. They are slowly like they are again like limiting the internet and also the electricity. So I think that the regime is slow, like they are preparing for this, but I really don't know if the people in Kurdistan or Balochistan will start the protests as they did in last year. So we just have to wait and see what's going to happen.
So thank you very much. And I just wondered if there are any final words that you want to say before we finish.
Well, thank you too for having me on this podcast. I try to give you as much as information I can. But one thing that I want to say is that if anybody is listening, the situation in East Kurdistan is not really good. And I think that the international activists, organizations must pay more attention, because one of the main reasons that people suffer is that nobody knows what's going on there. So I think as much as the international activists and organizations or the friends of Kurdish people are paying attention to Rojava issues or Bakur issues, they should pay attention to Rojhelat as well, because, you know, what's happening there, this revolution is a women-led revolution. It's something unique, and I believe that if one day it works out, it's going to change the situation for all the women, not just in Kurdistan, but all over the world. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And we'll all have to keep our eyes peeled for what's happening. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you too.